deadlines. Iran calls on the UN Security Council to hold certain states accountable for imposing unilateral sanctions as a method of war to starve innocent civilians. Russia urges Turkey to refrain from launching a military campaign in Syria, warning that such a move could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the situation there. And US President Joe Biden urges Congress to ban assault weapons and implement other gun control measures to curb the mass shootings plaguing the country. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has censured the Security Council for failing to fulfill its responsibility with regard to some serious violations of international law, in particular illegal sanctions on Iran. Majid Takht-Ravanchi told the council that certain states are using coercive measures as a method of war to starve innocent civilians. He underlined that the U.S. has targeted Iran with the most severe economic and financial sanctions, which directly endanger the lives of the most vulnerable in the population. The Iranian ambassador said the sanctions have even caused the deaths of some Iranian patients, including children, as a result of restrictions on medicine and medical supplies. He was addressing an open debate at the U.N. Security Council on strengthening accountability and justice for serious violations of international law. Political commentator Jim Kavanaugh says the sanctions warfare is at the heart of the current U.S. foreign policy.
The foreign policy of the United States now is based on sanctions. It's based on coercion and threats. And we've seen this before. Look, but it happened in Iraq. And Madeleine Albright is famous in the 90s for saying it was worth the price of 500,000 children, dead children, to sanction for the sanctions on the Saddam Hussein, you know, that went on for years and caused, she acknowledged, 500,000 dead children. So the United States now has a policy pursuing a foreign policy of sanctions, sanction warfare and siege warfare against countries that it wants to discipline. And, you know, like with Russia now and like with Iran, nothing Iran's going to do is going to stop these sanctions. The sanctions aren't going to stop until and unless Iran comes into compliance with the American and Israeli hegemony in the region. And Iran isn't about to do that. So, you know, that's really what it's about. And they're punishing them for not being compliant with American and Zionist program for the region. And Iran is a very powerful country and a strong and a big country, and they need to kind of cut it down if they can.
And Iran's health ministry says there have been no COVID-19 related deaths over the past day, a remarkable first in the country since the pandemic emerged in 2019. The total number of deaths stands at over 141,000. The ministry recorded 175 new infections in the past 24 hours. Health authorities are attributing the low numbers to the massive vaccination drive. They say the intensive nationwide campaign is now paying off. So far, nearly 150 million doses have been administered across the country, and nearly 60 million Iranians have been fully inoculated. China has warned any confrontational moves at the upcoming meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors will only undermine cooperation between Iran and the agency and disrupt the negotiation process on the revival of the 2015 deal. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman made the comments after reports said the US, the UK, France and Germany have prepared a draft resolution to push the Board of Governors to rebuke Iran at the board's June the 6th meeting. Zhao Lijian said exerting pressure on Iran and the UN agency will escalate tensions and complicate the situation. He called on Washington to make a political decision as soon as possible on the revival of the agreement known as the JCPOA. The official urged the White House to actively respond to what he called Iran's legitimate concerns and work toward an early consensus on outstanding issues. Russia urges Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey would cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has renewed the threats of a military offensive in northern Syria. He says Ankara wants to establish a 30-kilometer security zone along its southern border. Erdogan claims the military campaign aims to target terrorists, and Turkey has launched 3 incursions into Syria since 2016 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Damascus has repeatedly slammed Turkey for its illegal presence in Syria, saying Ankara is supporting terrorists in the north of the country. Turning elsewhere, U.S. President Joe Biden urges Congress to take sensible gun control measures that can address a string of recent mass shootings in the country.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21. Strengthen background checks. Enact safe storage law and red flag laws. Repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability. Address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence. These are rational, common sense measures.
Biden's proposed measures have been historically blocked by Republicans in Congress. Biden called on lawmakers not to fail the American people again, stressing that enough is enough. Gun safety advocates have pushed Biden to take stronger measures on his own to curb gun violence, but the White House wants Congress to pass legislation. The United States has a higher rate of gun deaths than any other wealthy nation. The country has been shaken in recent weeks by the high-profile mass shootings at a grocery store in New York, an elementary school in Texas that killed 19 children, and a medical building in Oklahoma. More than 18,000 people have died from gun violence in the United States in 2022. A Palestinian teenager shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, the fourth such killing in only 2 days. The Palestinian Health Ministry said the 17-year-old boy, Oda Mohammed, was killed with a bullet into his chest near the village of Al-Madia, west of Ramallah. Israeli regime forces killed 2 Palestinians on Wednesday and another this morning. At least 6 Palestinians have also been injured over the past 24 hours. In the meantime, hundreds of people held funerals for 2 of the Palestinians killed on Wednesday. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the International Criminal Court needs to break its silence over Israel's crimes.
The Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its barbaric violence against Palestinians. Israeli military forces have shot and killed a Palestinian woman in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the 31-year-old victim as Ghufran Haroun Hamed Warasne. The Tel Aviv regime claims the woman was trying to stab Israeli soldiers, but witnesses say that Warasne posed little threat to the soldiers. She has started a new job at a radio station 3 days prior to being killed.
This woman was apparently also a journalist, starting her first day of work. And it's hard for me to believe that this was someone attacking Israelis. This is an excuse. If they produced a knife, I can't imagine that it was the woman who had the wife. It was produced by the Israelis themselves.
The incident happened close to the Al-Arub refugee camp, located 15 kilometers south of Bethlehem. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said the Israeli forces prevented his medical staff from attending to Warasneh. They only managed to attend her 20 minutes after she was injured. The killing comes amid rising tensions between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the occupied territories. Local and international rights groups have condemned what they call Israel's excessive use of force and shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
They're being protected. The Israelis are being protected in the U.S. and most likely the rest of the Western countries. So are they being reckless? Well, if you live in a part of the world where you get the full information, yes, I think you could say that they're being reckless. But in fact, they're being permitted to continue their genocide and their recklessness without being held to account. This is the problem.
Israeli forces have been busy killing or injuring Palestinians, especially from the holy month of Ramadan onwards. But the Palestinians are not sitting idle either. Over the past 2 months, resistance fighters have also ramped up attacks against Israelis, which have left 18 settlers dead. That represents an unprecedented number since the Second Intifada in 2005.
In recent weeks, Israel has stepped up its provocative moves against Palestinians. Far-right Israeli extremists, supported by the regime, have just held the controversial flag march in Al-Quds. Israelis raided in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The march was aimed at celebrating the occupation and subsequent annexation of East Jerusalem in 1967, a move that has not been recognized by the international community. Some chanted racist slogans, including death to Arabs, and attacked Palestinian residents while backed by armed Israeli forces. Dozens of Palestinians were arrested across Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank a day earlier.
Well, everyone is asking that. And given the incitement that the Israelis are causing, the deliberate attempts to provoke Palestinians and to cause trouble and violence against Palestinians, then yes, it's very possible that the Palestinians will participate in an uprising. You could say there's an uprising right now against Israeli violence and provocations.
It's believed that Israel is deliberately fanning the flames of violence across the occupied territories. The clashes at Al-Quds had sparked fears of another armed conflict, similar to an 11-day war in May last year, between Israel and the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas.
It's, until now, at a relatively low level, but it could get, if it becomes really popular, and then the Palestinians could make a major uprising against the Israelis. And frankly, it's one of the few things that might bring the kind of attention to them that they really need. The world needs to look at it. And as I told you, here in the U.S., we're not getting that view unless we know where to look.
Back in May, Israeli forces killed Al Jazeera TV correspondent Shirin Abu Akleh while she was covering a military raid on the northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured and raised by Israeli forces and settlers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
Elsewhere, members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement in Nigeria have visited prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Ezekzaki. Danjuma Abdullahi sent in this report from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement in Nigeria have visited Sheikh Ibrahim Ezekzaki on the occasion of the anniversary of the passing away of the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. They described Imam Khomeini as a true leader who fought against oppression and injustice, not just in Iran, but everywhere around the world. Sheikh Zazaki described Imam Khomeini as an exemplary and upright leader who has become a role model for youths everywhere.
The Academic Forum consists of youths now. Now the youths who support the revolution in the 70s are now old people. Now the ball is in the court of the youth up to today, particularly in Nigeria, where we find ourselves in a situation of chaos.
Sheikh Sasaki said Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution was an inspiration to many people around the world who want to establish truth and social justice. He said the legacy of Imam Khomeini still lives on several decades after his passing.
He has shown the world that Islam, which has governed the world in the old time, is capable of governing the world of our own time. He has also shown that the power is in the hand of the people. It is the duty of the people to rise up to change the situation in their places.
Members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement said one of the basic lessons learned from Imam Khomeini is his stand against global oppression and arrogance. They said Imam Khomeini also emphasized Islamic unity and discouraged divisions in Islam. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
The United States has added 71 new Russian and Belarusian entities to its trade blacklist as part of its effort to deprive the Russian military of U.S. technology and other items. The blacklisted entities include aircraft plans and ship building and research institutes. These restrictions are among a raft of new U.S. sanctions imposed over Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine. In total, the U.S. Commerce Department has added over 320 entities to its economic blacklist for their links with the Russian military since late February. That brings it into World Bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Britain, the Labour Party has called for an investigation into leaked text messages suggesting there was a second gathering in Boris Johnson's Downing Street flat during lockdown, held by his wife, Carrie Johnson, on his birthday. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled Partygate, Labour urges inquiry into alleged second event at Number 10 hosted by Carrie Johnson. In Britain, the Labour Party has called for an investigation into leaked text messages suggesting there was a second gathering in Boris Johnson's Downing Street flat during lockdown, held by his wife, Carrie, on his birthday. The emergence of new evidence of an event hosted on 19th of June 2020, which was not mentioned in the Partygate report by senior civil servant Sue Gray, sparked accusations of a cover-up and calls for No. 10 Downing Street to come clean. The event has not been denied, but Carrie Johnson's spokesperson said that Sue Gray had been made aware of the texts as part of her exhaustive inquiry into alleged breaches of COVID rules. They added, "Staff were given ample opportunity to present evidence, including these messages, and all relevant information was passed on to the Metropolitan Police for investigation." The lunchtime gathering in the Cabinet Room on 19th of June 2020 was subsequently found to be in breach, and a fixed penalty notice was issued to Carrie Johnson, among others, for which she apologised unreservedly and promptly paid the fine. It was alleged that a Downing Street aide received a text from Boris Johnson's wife confirming that she was with two male friends in the flat, where the Prime Minister later joined them. At the time, strict lockdown rules meant indoor socialising was banned, but people could meet up in groups of six outdoors. An exemption to meeting was made where the gathering was reasonably necessary for work purposes. The gathering came hours after the birthday celebration held in the Cabinet Room, for which both Johnsons were fined by the Metropolitan Police. It is thought to be separate to a third event on Boris Johnson's birthday with his relatives, which took place in the Downing Street Garden and is thought to have adhered to the rules at the time. It was previously reported that a gathering was held in the flat on 13th of November 2020, with food and alcohol available and loud ABBA music being played. Sue Gray admitted she stopped investigating that particular event when the Metropolitan Police started their investigations and chose not to pursue her inquiry afterwards. Conservative MPs have expressed anger at the revelation. Angela Rayner, Labour Party's deputy leader, said the text messages had been suppressed and that the public deserved the truth about why the holding of a lockdown party in the Prime Minister's flat on his own birthday has not been made public until now. Angela Rayner added, "The revelation raises new questions about potential misconduct in public office, which must now be subject to proper and genuinely independent scrutiny, and that this looks like yet another cover-up." Angela Rayner called for the messages to be given to MPs under Privileges Committee, who are expected to begin their investigation into whether the Prime Minister misled Parliament by initially denying any COVID rules had been broken. In the letter, Angela Rayner also said Downing Street had previously denied that such a gathering took place and asked whether any other senior civil servants attended the meeting. A Cabinet Office spokesperson defended the integrity of Sue Gray's report, saying it was impartially conducted and its contents represent the findings and conclusions of the investigation team alone. Sue Gray made reference to the Cabinet Room gathering in her report, saying it lasted for 20 minutes and that those who attended ate food and drank alcohol. Photographs were published of Boris Johnson, the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, and the Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Her long-awaited findings, published on Wednesday, made no reference to any other gathering that day and only once mentioned the Prime Minister's wife, Carrie Johnson, in relation to a different event. However, the report did hint that other details might emerge, saying, "Given the piecemeal manner in which events were brought to my attention, it is possible that events took place which were not the subject of investigation." The Sunday Times reported that a Downing Street aide with a copy of the text from Carrie Johnson wrote to the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, stating they had their offer to share the messages with Sue Gray's team ignored. A Cabinet Office source said it was categorically not true that such evidence was ignored. They added that the exchange with the aide about the material was part of the information that had been provided to the Metropolitan Police. However, the claims threatened to reignite anger over the Partygate scandal, under which the Prime Minister has sought to draw a line. A government source admitted that Sue Gray's report had not set off the political implosion some anticipated, but added that the consequence would probably lead to a gradual drip of other damning details. Tory MPs thought to have submitted a no-confidence letter in the Prime Minister agreed. "It's bad," one said. "It is never going to go away. There's going to be a steady stream of new revelations. It's just going to keep on." Another Conservative MP speculated there would be a drip, drip, drip of further evidence. A No. 10 Downing Street spokesperson said, "Sue Gray and the Metropolitan Police have completed their inquiries. The Prime Minister cooperated fully with both investigations."
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And here is a saying of the Prophet's 18th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, in honor of his noble sister, Hazrat Masume, peace upon her, who reposes in Qom. Paradise is the reward for the one who visits her shrine, aware of her status.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is A to Z.
An Introduction into an Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Behaving with the Enemies. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about how to behave with the enemies and our behaving with the enemies. When we look at the Islamic context, it says us that even if two people have dispute with each other, or maybe there are two different people who are enemies of each other, Islam stops us to be first in having this kind of thinking that we are enemies. The actual thing that Islam says is that you need to get rid of the concept of being enemy of each other or harming each other. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, it is said that it is not good to have dispute all the time. Why? Because, you know, when we are having a dispute, we are basically spending our time in that and we are wasting our time. Therefore, it is necessary, according to the teachings of the Prophet ﷺ, that even if you have a dispute or if you have a dispute or there is an enemy of you, show the nobility of yourself to him. Be noble with him. And this, if you are a person who is noble, you can obviously can show generosity to him. And this will change the minds of your enemies. Even if they have done bad to you, on the first step, show generosity, be noble, and be kind with them. So when you show this will change their mind. And if they're not changing, then obviously there are the other steps that you can take. But the first thing that the Islamic teachings teaches us is that we need to be to have the generosity, we need to have mercy, we need to have kindness with the people with whom we have disputes. Maybe they do not accept our things that we say. But the first thing is that we should not be amongst those who takes the first step in having this dispute. Therefore, we need to deal with the people with the generosity, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of behaving with the enemies. And we said that the Islamic teachings teaches us that when we need to deal with the enemies, the first thing is do not take the first step in having this dispute and have your generosity and kindness with the enemies, even those who have dispute with you. The second thing which Islamic teachings teaches us is that if you have a dispute with someone or if you know that there is an enemy of you, but you never know that he will bring a harm to you or not, do not get engaged with such an enemy. And if you believe and if you know that he will never harm you, then obviously there is no need of having any engagement with such an enemy. Or if in general life, if we have someone with whom we have dispute, so it is better to not to talk about them, not to, you know, highlight the things that they say. Why? Because it saves us from many things, and many problems that we can have in our life. It will save us from those things. And that is the thing which Islam teaches us. And obviously, when you know your enemies, Islam also tells us that be careful that tomorrow if they come in the face of a friend, when they dress up as a friend and when they come to you, remember that they were your enemies. For example, when in the Quran, Allah talks about the story of the Prophet Adam and Eve, there Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells them that the shaitan is your enemy. And we know that Shaitan came in the dress of friend. He dressed up as a friend and he came as a friend in front of them. And he gave them this advice of eating that specific plant, which was prohibited by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, we need to be very much careful when we deal with the enemies, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A man in the city of Soran in Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region has become a local celebrity for a rather peculiar feature on his face. Hussein Abdullah Ahmed is famous for a record-breaking length of his mustache. Ahmed has been going by the name Mr. Mustache for decades now. His mustache has reached the length of 2.4 meters, making him a well-known man in the city he hails from. His son says, however, that his father's unusual feature is nothing new for him.
I've always known my father likes this since I was born, although there were times when I had seen his mustache short. My dad is famous for his mustache, and we're proud of him.
Ahmed admits his mustache troubles him while working on the farm or trying to sleep, but to avoid the trouble, he either ties it from behind or stuffs it under his clothes. The 73-year-old man is not planning to get rid of his facial hair, which he hasn't trimmed since 1994. He seems to be enjoying the ride of fame as people stop him on the streets to take selfies with him.
A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass-bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass-bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular. The engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. The contemporary ceramics exhibition kicks off at the Villa d'Atres Art Foundation near the French city of Avignon. The exhibit showcases nearly 130 artworks of all sizes. Some are so big they are put on display outdoors. The foundation has curated these modern forms from roughly 100 artists from all over the world. The exhibit displays an exceptional diversity of eclectic works presenting sophisticated skills and artistry. Participating artists say working with clay and playing with glazes always produces a unique item that often generates a profoundly universal reaction. The goal of the event is to show how ceramic art has returned to the forefront of the contemporary art scene. The annual Vivid Life Festival has returned to Sydney after being cancelled 2 years in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic. The event kicked off with fireworks and lighting the sails of the Sydney Opera House. Iconic structures like the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia are part of a series of new canvases this time around. As an added treat, the 2022 festival also has the longest continuous light walk in the history of the event. Plus, this year's highlights include a choreographed light show by 600 drones. Both residents and tourists have been anticipating the return of the show.
I saw it about 8 years ago, I think, and it's just got better and better, as far as I can tell. I mean, the Opera House is the most amazing canvas possible to project, this just amazing digital artwork. The vibrancy of it, the colour of it, the animation of it, the explosiveness of it, the colour just bursts out in just amazing ways. That the snakes, the chameleons, the lizards crawling across it.
The Harbour City will glow with 50 light installations, the projection artworks, as well as over 100 musical events. Vivid Sydney is an annual festival that lasts for 23 nights, infusing art, innovation and technology while collaborating with boundary-pushing artists. In 2019, the festival attracted millions of attendees. The event is owned and managed by the Tourism and Major Events Agency of the Government of New South Wales. Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by six centuries. The bristlecone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientist who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4 meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial alerce. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Boricevich is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Costero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The world's oldest living man has just turned 113 years and says he is going to be around at least 10 more years. Good for him. Born on May the 27th, 1909 in Venezuela, Juan Vicente Perez Mora is still in pink of his health and memory and does not take medication. He has no trouble recalling his childhood marriage and the names of his siblings, children and grandchildren. He has 41 grandchildren, by the way. So what is the secret behind a long life? Work hard, rest on holidays, go to bed early, love for God, and always carry him in your heart. The Guinness World Records declared Perez Mora the oldest living person last week.
The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscious of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
After watching the tragedy at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, unfold after so many other shootings in recent weeks, I'm wondering what I might have missed when I was asked to start the FBI's active shooter program 10 years ago. Did I have my team focus on the wrong problems? Did I spend my budget wisely to find ways to save lives? The article you're about to hear has been written by Catherine Schwate, an FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program after the shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012. Catherine Schwate retired in 2017 after 20 years of service. The article has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times and is titled, "I Created the FBI's Active Shooter Program. The officers in Uvalde did not follow their training." After watching the tragedy at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, unfold after so many other shooting incidents in recent weeks, I'm wondering what I might have missed when I was asked to start the FBI's active shooter program 10 years ago. Did I have my team focus on the wrong problems? Did I spend my budget wisely to find ways to save lives? Every shooting is evaluated in three parts. How could we have prevented the shooting? Did we respond effectively to save lives? And how are we helping the community to recover? Last Monday, the FBI designated 61 shooting incidents in 2021 as active shooter attacks, up from 40 in 2020, and 30 incidents in 2019. We aren't preventing the shootings, I realized. Perhaps I thought we were doing better in responding to the attacks as they unfolded. But if the 78 minutes that the police in Uvalde, Texas waited before confronting the gunman at the Robb Elementary School are any indication, the answer is, we are not. Waiting so long, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety said on Friday, was the wrong decision, period. So why did the police leadership make that call? In the first few years after the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in December of 2012, the FBI spent more than $30 million to send agents to police departments around the country. The goal was to train local police officers in how to handle active shooter incidents so they would know how to go after a shooter with confidence and neutralize the threat. The day after the FBI released its latest active shooter figures, the Robb Elementary School was attacked. In the past 2 years, the Uvalde School District has hosted at least two active shooter trainings, according to reporting by the New York Times. One of them was 2 months ago. Current protocol and best practices say officers must persistently pursue efforts to neutralize a shooter when a shooting is underway. This is true even if only one officer is present. This is without question the right approach. We need to understand why that protocol was not followed in Uvalde, Texas. I'm still confident the FBI's focus on training to this standard was right. But I'm less confident in its execution. The police officers who responded may have been unprepared for conflict, which can lead to fatal results. Law enforcement officers need to be mentally prepared before they arrive on the scene, so they can respond immediately. Repetitive training builds practice and confidence. Big gatherings for training every few years are more expensive and less effective for muscle memory. Instead, departments should consider more virtual tabletop exercises they can run through in an afternoon. Have police officers walk through schools and talk with one another about how they would respond. Require police officers to check all their gear before they begin a shift. Last year, active shooters killed 103 people and injured 140 others in 30 states. Five of those attacks were in Texas. Most of our more than 800,000 law enforcement officers in the United States are in small departments. This is not the first time a law enforcement agency has failed in the way it responded. At times, training can become routine and be taken less seriously in any environment, but agencies should be careful to avoid complacency. Are they undertaking the training to check a box? Police department leaders need to tell their officers today what is expected of them and to understand that Americans demand it. We also need to reevaluate how we advise students and teachers to react when an active shooter enters a school. After the Sandy Hook incident, the federal government adopted the Run, Hide, Fight model, which instructs students and teachers to run first if they can, then hide if they must, and finally fight to survive. Today, schools at best are giving lip service to the first part of that mantra, to run. Most schools that train for a shooting incident urge their students, teachers, and other staff members to lock out or hide from a shooter, but almost never to run for their lives if they can. My friend Frank DeAngelis, a retired principal of Columbine High School in Colorado, told me he wished his students and faculty had been taught to flee. At Sandy Hook, 9 first graders survived when they were able to flee their classroom, thanks to their brave teacher, Victoria Lee Soto, who was shot and killed when she stood in front of the killer. I still have nightmares about details from school shootings in which survivors told me they huddled under their desks, hoping against logic that the shooter would not see them. It's hard to shed the images of victims' bodies found huddled under plastic tables, behind cloth partitions, or together in a group against the wall. I remember telling my children that if someone approached them in a car while they were walking, they should run as fast as they can and as far as possible. Yet in many school settings, we have mistakenly discouraged students from trying their best to simply stay alive. Now my youngest child is a teacher whose middle school classroom is near the end of a hall with a side door to the outside. The classrooms are filled with desks. She knows that killers who strike schools will take advantage of opportunities to find more victims. I share my daughter's experience not to invite criticism of the actions of educators responding to lethal situations, but to underscore how vital proper training is to the survival of teachers and their students. We're told the best way to learn is from the mistakes that we make. According to data from the FBI, in recent years, the average number of casualties per active shooter attack has declined, even as the number of attacks has actually increased. I think this reflects better policing and improved public awareness. Still, police will not likely be there in the critical first minutes of an attack on a school. In the aftermath of the wrenching tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, it's clear that nearly 10 years after the Sandy Hook incident, we must ask ourselves if the training designed to safeguard us against killers